I mean, though it was a short notice, but I wouldn't miss the opportunity for anything. I mean, it's really wonderful to be here. And once I remember long ago, Gabby had tried to bring me here 7 or 8 years ago. Well, it was very unfortunate that I couldn't come at that time. So this is my first visit. So what I'm going to talk about is this, we've been looking at disorder and how it affects the properties of strongly correlated systems, particularly transition metal oxide specifically, that's what I'll be talking about. There was a work that long ago Gabby and I did, but I'll not be talking about those systems, but of our concern in more recent times. Before I start talking, I should point out that experimental results that I'm going to present span over more than a decade, and some of the experiments actually started 16, 17 years ago and are about to get over now. And so it's been running on a very slow burner. It has involved many, many people from all over the world, several generations of students and postdocs who have, most of whom, in fact, all of whom, have now left the group, and their faculty members in various spaces or doing postdoc at different places. And many of my colleagues all over the world who have contributed very significantly. I'll cite the publications wherever we have published the data, and you'll find all the details about the authors as well as further details of the experiment there. And this is my opportunity to say what, I mean, to get back sort of when the big theoreticians come to our experimental group and say that we'll not show you too many equations. So it's my turn to tell you that I'll try not to show you too many experimental data, too many dirty experimental data, and only the essential points. So I'll be showing you several segments. It's sort of a collage of various aspects, but the underlying theme is going to be the effect of strong disorder in transition metal oxide systems. Okay, so I'll be spending some time on this compound that you have been looking at for quite some time now nearly a decade, SR2FeMO6, which is known as the ordered double perovskite structure, which is in general a composition of some rare earth or some non-interesting element. It could be a lanthanide or one of the these alkaline earth elements here, but it has two transition metal ions, B and B prime. Specifically the one that I'm talking about is iodine and molybdenum, and then an oxygen. It could be something else, but you have been looking at only mainly oxygen. And this is known as an ordered double perovskite structure, and I'll explain to you why we have this specific name. And I'll deal with, without any disorder, the electronic and magnetic properties of this particular sample to start with, and then I'll show you what the drastic consequences of disorder can be on a sample like this. Why we call it ordered double perovskite structure becomes evident from this supercell that I've drawn. All of you presumably know about perovskite structure. Those of you who don't know, it's very easy to visualize it. Think of a cube, and for example, I mean, idealized lanthanum manganate is a perovskite structure. And if you want to think of it, think of a cube. And if this is your cube, at the cube corners you put your manganese, at edge center you put the oxygens, and a body center position you put the lanthanum. And you can forget about the lanthanum, that's only to stabilize this cube. So you can forget about the lanthanum, and you think of the manganese at the cube corners and oxygen at the center of the edges, and you get the cubic perovskite structure essentially. So the electrical, electronic and magnetic properties are controlled by the fact that you have a manganese at the cube corner, and then you have six oxygens along the edges, right? All six directions. You have six oxygens that make a MnO6 octahedron, and this octahedron is connected to a subsequent octahedron by the sharing of an oxygen at the center of the edge along all the three directions. So it's a corner-shared octahedral motif that makes the cubic perovskite structure. So this would be a cubic perovskite structure if you have only one transition metal ion, like manganese, as I said. But since you have two different transition metal ions, in general B and B prime, what you could do is, this is the small cubic unit which could have made me the cubic perovskite structure if I had B at all corners B. But suppose I now order the system in such a way that I have a B here and a B prime here and a B here and a B prime here along the A axis as well as along the B axis and also along the C axis. So evidently what I have done is that because of this ordering of the B and B prime sublattice, my lattice vector is no more this distance, but it becomes doubled, and that's why I call it doubled part of sky structure, and that's of course driven by the fact that I have ordering. If I could completely disorder the substance, and if I such that the probability of finding a B or B prime is equal at any cube corner, then I'll not have ordering. It will be a perfectly disordered system, and that perfectly disordered system will no more be a double perovskite, but will be a simple cubic perovskite. And this is one particular system where it affords us the flexibility of continuously varying the ordering, going from almost completely ordered to perfectly disordered state, so that you can change the system and study the effect of ordering on a substance like that. This particular substance became very popular, lots of people started looking at it for several very good reasons. One of the reasons is that it is one of the things that you call the half metallic ferromagnet. It's a ferromagnet, first of all. It has a very high TC. It has a TC of about 420 Kelvin. It's a metallic system. And we call it half metallic. Of course, since it's ferromagnetic, the up spin density of states and the down spin densities of states are very different. It turns out that in one of the spin channels, up spin channel, for example, you have a gap at the Fermi energy, whereas it's a down spin channel that makes the system metallic. Which means that the electrons that are the charge carriers that are responsible for making the system metallic is entirely made of one particular kind of spins. In this case, by this convention, the down spin. So this is a source of 100% spin polarized material. So if you want to have a 100% spin polarized source, materials like this would be very good. Lanthanum strontium manganate, lanthanum calcium manganate in some of the doping levels are supposed to be also half metallic ferromagnets. And such materials, because of this extreme spin polarization, the ideal spin polarization 100%, also give rise to very strong magnetoresistive effects. Right, because you can see that if you took two pieces of the same material and had them oriented, spin orientation up and down, and made them in contact with each other, it will not conduct at all, simply because up spin, the down spin electrons in one case is conducting, in the other case, since you have reversed the spin, it will be the up spin electrons that will become conducting, so the up spin electron has no chance to jump to the piece that you have oriented wrongly. So ideally, it can have 100% magnetoresistance. So in general, half metallic ferromagnets give rise to very strong magnetoresistive effect, and indeed it did. This particular thing was first found by Tokura, as many other cases, magnetoresistance being very, very high. So this is our result. Tokura published in Nature in 1999 on this material. And what it showed is that you have a very sharp magnetoresistance. So I'm plotting the percentage change in the resistance as a function of applied magnetic field at two temperatures, 5 Kelvin and 300 Kelvin. And you can see the precipitous drop. I mean, it's within a 0.1 Tesla applied magnetic field in a polycrystalline sample, no special grain boundary designing, etc., which you have to do if you have to work with manganite. Since this particular compound followed the huge activity and enthusiasm in the manganite case, inevitably this compound had to be all the time compared against manganite. That was the sort of benchmark, and one had to say whether it is better or worse. And it turns out that it was much better in terms of the fact that it's a much lower field response. There are many technological reasons why you'd like a lower field response, and as you can see, with a 0.1 Tesla application, it precipitously drops. And even at 300 Kelvin, you have this 5% magnetoresistance at very small magnetic field. This won't be the case with the manganate. For example, lanthanum calcium manganate, if you take, it will not have any sharp low field magnetoresistance at 300 Kelvin. The reason is very simple. The reason is that this material has a TC which is 420 Kelvin, larger than 300 Kelvin, whereas lanthanum calcium manganate has a TC of about 250 Kelvin. So it's essentially connected with that, which is nice. So one believes that, look, here is a very simple system. It's perfectly cubic, not messed up like the manganite, where Yontiller distortions play a very important role. The questions, issues about a dynamic Yontiller, even in the doped state, etc., become very important. And I'll be talking about that later.
What's the oxidation state? Is it 3 plus 3 plus or 2 plus
3? No, iron is 3 plus, molybdenum is 5 plus.
3 plus 5.
Yeah. It's a rather unusual state of molybdenum, because molybdenum likes to be in 6 plus and 4 plus states, and they don't like to be in 5 plus state. We claim that it did.
Okay.
So I'm talking about only the nominal one. So we have a paper in 2000, which I'll be citing very soon. Or the 2001 paper. In one of the cases, we have given some photoelectron spectroscopic evidence that it does phase separate.
Does charge disproportionate?
We believe so. The reason I'm being very, very cautious about is that the sample is notorious for showing different kind of spectra depending on way you handle it. So we have been, in fact, trying to do the high energy photo emission, and we hope to be able to do it this summer. Then we'll know exactly what really is going on in the bulk. But so far, as we believe, that it does disproportionate into 4 plus and 6 plus like objects. Okay, so it has a very complex molybdenum spectrum. If molybdenum has a single valency, you'd see, expect a single simple peak. It invariably shows multiple peaks. Right?
So is there charge ordering?
No. It's dynamic in the sense that it's not. Every lattice site is equivalent. Uh-huh. So if you look at crystallographically, all the lattice sites are perfectly equivalent. Okay? It's a metallic system, so depending on. It really is a dynamic
disposition. It's a short time scale.
Yeah, that's what the mental image about the system is.
Can I ask a more general question?
Sure.
What's the magic in the double perovskite structure that lets you get the Curie temperature to be so high?
No, but there's no magic. I mean, that's the next thing I'm going to explain to you. There was a magic because we... Okay, let me just get on with it.
When were these things discovered?
As usual, in 50s, but rediscovered in 1999 when Tokuda found that it has a very strong magnetic resistance. Realize that it has very strong advantages, so lots of people jumped onto this from the manganite. The advantages are that it has a very large magnetic resistance at higher temperature and lower field. This comparative statement, higher and lower, of course, compares it to the manganite, which is always the benchmark. The reason that it's at higher temperature and lower field is primarily associated with the fact that you have a high ferromagnetic transition temperature, which is 420 Kelvin. And then a few other things that I've already mentioned, that it's a half metallic ferromagnet, it has a very simple crystal structure, essentially cubic with very small distortion, doesn't seem to have any of the messing up with the Jahn-Teller distortion. So one believes that both the experimentally as well as theoretically, it should be a very simple system to understand. Till one started looking at a bit more closely and figured out that one doesn't understand the very beginning, at the very starting point. The starting point being, as I say, that it has a very high transition temperature. One doesn't understand why it has a very high transition temperature. And as I'll argue in a moment, that not only depending on the crystal structure, you'd not only expect the transition temperature to be low, you'd also expect that the magnetic structure not to be ferromagnetic but antiferromagnetic. So instead of being a low temperature antiferromagnet, as one would expect the crystal structure to suggest, you have a very high temperature ferromagnet, and that's a puzzling fact. And the reason, let me motivate you, why we believe that it should be a low temperature antiferromagnet, here is the structure once again. So we have the material made of iron, molybdenum, and oxygen. As I already told you, I'm going to order the iron in alternate corner sites. So there's an iron here, and there's iron there. There's a molybdenum here. As I've told you, the strontium poor chap, we have forgotten about it because he is there only to stabilize the structure. We have the oxygen shown over here. Every edge center has an oxygen, but only for clarity I have shown it over here. So how can iron interact with iron? Remember that the only magnetic element, so to speak, in the material is iron. Molybdenum and oxygen are not magnetic. What do I mean by not magnetic and this being magnetic is obvious, that the intraatomic Hund's interaction strength, the energy between the parallel spin configuration and the antiparallel spin configuration, in a pair is very large in iron compared to the typical bandwidth of 3D that iron 3D would form, whereas for molybdenum and oxygen, it's very small. Actually, it's in the order of 1 electron volt, the Kunz coupling strength in iron, whereas in molybdenum, it's about 0.1 electron volt. That's because you're moving from 3D to 4D. That's the reason why molybdenum compounds are not magnetic. Iron compounds are, in general, magnetic. You'll not find a molybdenum compound of any kind which is magnetic by itself. So the iron has to interact with the iron, and it has to interact through these non-magnetic stuff, and that's 180 degrees interaction, and that should be a super exchange dominated. And that, given the fact that I'm talking about iron 3D5 and 3D5, it should be a very, is a super exchange that will couple them antiferromagnetically. So I should have the iron and iron coupling with each other antiferromagnetically rather than ferromagnetically. So that's why one would expect from the structure that it should be antiferromagnet. Not only that, one should expect that the nail temperature to be very small for the reason that the separation between the iron is nearly 8 angstrom. Compare this with the manganite that I told you about, where almost essentially the same structure of a manganese here and a manganese here and a manganese here, so the distance between manganese and manganese is half, right? Where I said that the Curie temperature is actually lower, it's about 250 Kelvin. I mean, that's a very unusual situation that you take two magnetic elements that have to interact with each other and then pull them apart and make a bigger distance and they begin to interact more strongly. I mean, a friend of mine said that the only case he knows where separation increases apparent attraction is in social context and not in magnetism.
Isn't this a false dichotomy? I mean, all the other examples that you said, the stuff in between is insulating and the moly is metal, right?
Pardon?
All the other examples you cited, the stuff in between is insulating, it's filtered.
That's right.
Moly is metal.
Absolutely. And that's going to make all the difference, of course, that we have one electron left here, but that electron is not normally polarized. That's the point, right? So that's why I said it's non-magnetic. And let me tell you then why it then happens. Okay, the argument that I gave just to motivate you, that is not just an argument or a sleight of hand, that there is experimental realization of exactly that situation, is that you take this SR2FeMOO6, the molybdenum compound, and replace molybdenum with tungsten. Tungsten appears in the periodic table just below molybdenum, so you're not changing electron count, right? And that material is indeed, this material is indeed an antiferromagnet with a nail temperature of 37 Kelvin.
Is it insulating?
It is insulating, of course. I'm not telling you because that's the point. That's the difference, right? So it's 37 Kelvin antiferromagnet. So indeed, there is antiferromagnetic interaction, super exchange, and that has a low strength of interaction.
Isn't that one like 2 plus 6 plus the iron?
Here it will be 2 plus 6 plus. That is what is going to make it insulating, exactly. And this becomes completely evident. I'll skip all the detailed results that you have, but I'll just show you this schematically and tell you what really is going on and why the antiferromagnetism comes. So let's consider the iron site. Iron site, what do I have? I have a spin splitting, this strong Hund's coupling splitting that I talked about. So the iron up spin states are here, but the down spin states are very high up. And I have this molybdenum oxygen derived states, which are out here. And what is the crucial aspect of the electronic structure is that this state, which is not polarized, so the Hund's coupling strength is very small, and I've only for clarity shown a very small gap of about 1/10 of that, but you can think that because of bandwidths are much larger, this electron that I have put here, this single electron, has no preference of being up or down, but this appears within this exchange gap. And that's a crucial point. Now, if you now allow this electron to hop around, so basically if you have a hopping interaction between the molybdenum oxygen hybrid states and the iron states, what would happen, since the hopping is spin conserving, the up states will interact with the up states and the down states will interact with the down states that way. So this interacts with that interacts with that, and it's like the classic bonding, antibonding splitting. All that's going to happen is that this state will get pushed up, this state will get pushed down because of the hopping. And in that case, you have derived a very large, effective spin splitting of something that was completely unpolarized to start with, and the electron will very strongly favor to be here rather than go there. It will cost it an enormous amount of energy to go there. Essentially, this mechanism, then what it does is to couple the local moment very strongly antiferromagnetically with the conduction electron. Of course, as soon as you have that, it doesn't have to be antiferromagnetic. As long as you have the local moment coupled very strongly with the electron that's hopping around, in whatever orientation, as long as you have a strong coupling, that will drive the local moment to be ferromagnetic, simply because at this point it will be coupled this way, then it hops to the next site, and it will force the next site also to be in the same orientation to lower the energy. And that's why the iron will now become ferromagnetic. So here, the instead of in the manganite, this double exchange mechanism where you have the fact that the two spins are oriented in the same direction, the hopping, the one that's hopping in the EG band and the local T2G spin, that's the energy scale of that given by the Hund's coupling strength. The Hund's coupling strength is completely irrelevant here because it's completely filled, D5. What really matters is the energy of the hopping. That provides the energy scale, and that's a very large energy scale, and that gets you to the high TC. And if you do the calculation with realistic parameters, you find that actually coupling between the iron standard to be larger than what you'd expect in manganite, and that we had shown in this particular paper.
What is the bandwidth of this molybdenum oxygen band?
I'll show you the band calculation, the widths, possibly later, but I'll tell you, yeah. And it's there in this. This one
yeah.
is reasonably broad. This is very narrow. Okay? That's a big, it's basically based on how it is placed within this exchange splitting.
Daisy,
yep.
How much do we have to worry, if at all, about spin orbit now that we're 4D? I'm so used to thinking about 3D.
That's right. Okay. In the 4D case, it turns out that it's still, we don't have to worry too much. It plays but a role, but not, in this particular case, very strong effect.
Electrovolts or even less?
It's certainly... tenth of an electron volt. In fact, for the late transition elements, you're getting close to 100 MeV. It's about 50 MeV, 60 MeV in that order. Early ones are in the order of 10, 20, 30 MeV. But when you go to the 5D in the double perovskite, and there's this chromium osmium, which is an insulating ferromagnet,
because of the,
The spin orbit plays a very important role. And I'll show you a schematic right now that will explain to you why a spin orbit becomes important in those cases, can have very important consequences. Okay, so but having convinced you that it ought to be high temperature ferromagnet, now I'll have to go back and tell you why the tungsten analog is a low temperature antiferromagnet. The reason is very simple, that what you change going from molybdenum to tungsten is these 4D states would float up and the 5D states would appear higher up. Okay, so that if molybdenum 4D derived states were here, the tungsten 5D states are up there. And as soon as that happens, you can see that this interaction and that interaction don't have this differential splitting opening up. It'll state push both up and down spin states up. And for energetic reason, the single electron that is there would flow in here. And that's the reason why iron will now become 2+, tungsten will become D0, 6+. And you'll have now the iron will have to interact through oxygen fully filled and tungsten entirely empty states, and that will bring in only the super exchange left for you, and that will couple antiferromagnetically the iron states. Okay. There will, of course, be solid-state effects. These will split into bands, and you can have a much simpler picture of all this. Is basically that you have a local moment that's strongly split, so upper above this horizontal line, electronic structure is for upspin, below it or downspin. And this, whenever you have a scenario that you have this upspin and the downspin, the exchange splitting is large and you have a partially filled band which is unpolarized appearing in this gap, you'll immediately find that because of this differential hopping effects, you'll have an exchange splitting of this kind, right? And then whatever the electrons, unpolarized electrons that were there, will polarize itself very strongly, giving rise to a coupling between the upspin local moment and the downspin electrons. And it can so happen, as I mentioned, that it is half metallic ferromagnet. Depending on the electron filling and the hopping strength, that means this exchange, effective exchange splitting, you can have the Fermi energy here, which gives you a half metallic state. But if you have more electron filling, it will go in there, then it will not be half metallic, but that's a matter of detail. So the half metallic density is not a requirement for ferromagnetism here. It's just a consequence of the detail that we have only one electron, and this hopping interactions are strong enough to split this unpolarized state strongly. Incidentally, we believe that this is also at the root of interaction between ferromagnetism in manganese-doped gallium arsenide. And of course, disorder and other things play a very important role. At a microscopic level, the fact that the manganese polarizes the gallium arsenide doped hole is exactly this mechanism. And I'll try to motivate you with some results very soon. But before I do that, as I already said, that half metallicity is a consequence of the details. But this model has been misunderstood by many often to say that necessarily the system must be metallic to derive ferromagnetism in this particular model. But that's not the case at all. For example, you have a low dope case and you have very few electrons here, and if you have disorder, strong disorder, these states can get localized in the Anderson sense, but that is not going to affect the ferromagnetism at all. So you can have an Anderson localized in the low doping limit. You can even in the high doping limit, you can have an insulating state, high density limit, because you can have other interaction like spin orbit interaction that splits the state that was like this into other features. It could be crystal field effect, it could be spin orbit, and in fact it is realized in the chromium osmium case, and you can have the thing falling there. In chromium osmium it happens to be exactly this kind of a situation, that you have an insulating ferromagnet but with a very high temperature in the order of 600 Kelvin or 700 Kelvin.
But in this mechanism it's very important that the hybridization between the molybdenum and the iron is much bigger than the molybdenum-molybdenum hopping.
The bandwidth.
Yes.
So exactly. Well, and yes and no, in the sense, no. The point is, it'll only make it whether it's half metallic or not. See, the point is that if it is not, that's still not going to matter. Suppose if that was, so all that I'm saying, this bandwidth comes from molybdenum-molybdenum interaction. The splitting is driven by the interaction between this and that state, right? If it is small, my splitting would be small, but it still would be ferromagnetic.
Right. But the metallicity is not crucial.
Metallicity is not crucial.
You get rid of the bandwidth of the molybdenum, and this still was still.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So we'll see the sweet spot.
No. If you do this, it's just that there is an optimum for TC and things like that, which depends on both the bandwidth and the strength of the coupling, and there's some nice ratio between them.
So how does the bandwidth help you to get high TC?
Well, that's what I wanted to ask. I remember working, I wrote a paper on this in about 90.
Yes, you did. You did. Okay.
But in this picture so far, there's nothing that leads me to believe that increasing the bandwidth will make the material better.
No.
It'll make it worse.
Yes. Okay. It'll make it worse, if anything, because what would happen is that you'll have up and down spin, and so basically you'll have spin scattering and all kinds.
It will weaken the driving.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. But okay, we can discuss those details separately. But at this point, I'd like to point out one more thing, that the some arguments about manganese-doped gallium arsenide, at least when we were talking about this at that time, manganese-doped gallium arsenide, people were talking about RKKY type of interaction. Okay, and RKKY type of interaction is, RKKY is the wrong limit to talk about.
That's
completely opposite limit, completely opposite limit, right?
Right.
Where the spin splitting is much smaller than the Fermi energy. And here, half metallicity implies that the spin state is much larger. So if you have a half metallic state, you don't start talking about RKKY. You can't be a second order perturbation expansion, right? So, okay, that's enough about that. Now, so I'll just quickly tell you, I mean, it turns out that this particular compound, that this particular mechanism really shows up in very diverse cases to explain magnetism, manganese-doped gallium arsenide, this pyrochlore structure. I'll not go through all of them, but this one I'll quickly show one particular aspect and one very nice experiment that was done by Ali Azdani. So everything remains same. Instead of the iron D5, it's manganese D states. Instead of molybdenum oxygen states, it's gallium arsenide P states. Instead of one electron, you have one hole. Everything else goes through it, so I don't have to belabor the point. But Now, if you, in this mechanism, if you ask what is the interaction strength and is it anisotropic, the RKQI will give you, there can be some amount of anisotropy, but it actually turns out to be very weak normally, even if you take the real Fermi surface in this particular case. And here, what the calculation shows is that you take one manganese and put it at one site and take another test manganese and put it into different crystallographic orientations and calculate the energy difference between the parallel configuration and the anti-parallel configuration and find out the energy difference, which is the energy of the interaction, measure of the energy of the interaction, and see if there's a dependence on the direction and the distance. And it turns out that the directional dependence is very, very strong. Whenever I put two manganese along the 110 direction, it's always the interaction energy is high compared to if I put it along the 100 direction. And it's independent of the distance. This is the distance axis, and you can see that I can put two manganese exactly at the same distance, one along 110 direction, another along 411 direction. And it turns out the 411 direction is almost zero interaction strength, whereas in the 110 direction, it's a very large interaction strength. So it's extremely direction dependent. And remember that along the 110, it's high. Along 100, it's low. So you have this kind of a behavior.
That calculation is from RKKY? Or
No. This is from band structure calculation that includes everything, right? And since we are talking about basically hopping driven, it's that hopping anisotropy that's reflecting itself. So you can very easily understand this direction dependence from the fact that you have T2Gs interacting. Okay, what Ali Yazdani, they did was to, these are beautiful pictures, they essentially measured this interaction strength. The way they measured is that they can put two manganese next to each other like this on a gallium arsenide surface, and then they can do the scanning tunneling spectroscopy on it, and they can look at this structure. The splitting between these two peaks is a measure of the interaction strength between the two manganese. And that splitting they have plotted, and you can see 110, 100, 110, etc. Follows exactly the trend that you had predicted about 2 or 3 years ago before this experiment was done. Okay, now on I talk about disorder effects. Magnetoresistance I have already shown you, and you see the point is that this magnetoresistance that I showed you earlier, which is for an ordered object, but if I take a disordered sample, and as I said that we found out, we realized how to control this order, extent of ordering very carefully, and it turns out that the magnetoresistance becomes very different. In particular, the low field magnetoresistance can vanish completely.
Is that because you drove the Curie temperature down?
No, nope. The Curie temperature remains more or less the same, but something else happens. Okay. So the question is, why does the magnetoresistance change so drastically? And that brings some other question that I'll explain as I go along. Okay, so what disorder am I talking about? I'm talking about anti-site disorder. I've already told you about this, that the ordered system has iron, molybdenum, iron. This should have been a molybdenum, but here, this iron-molybdenum pair have interchanged, and we call it an anti-site defect. So this is the, what is the effect of this? As you can see immediately that, first of all, I bring an iron-iron near neighbor interacting through oxygen, and that's a strong antiferromagnetic structure. So that will try to drive this iron into an antiferromagnetic state with respect to these. And also at the same time, this molybdenum derived its polarization by the fact that it had irons all around it, but this molybdenum, now you can see, has molybdenum, 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 molybdenum around it, so it will get depolarized. Which will mean the coupling between the irons, though they remain, may remain on an average upspin, but it will not be strongly coupled, and so you can depolarize the band, and therefore the magnetization can come down. So the issue is, which one does it happen? Okay, experimentally, how do you check that? It's very simple. You can do X-ray diffraction, and then there are very small peaks like this, which expanded shows here. That's very highly ordered state, and we can make it disordered, and you can see hardly any of this ordering state. And by intensity measurement and more detailed fitting, you can give a number for what the extent of ordering is. But yeah,
now going back to the charge fluctuation issue, so that would be very detrimental to your mechanism because the D level will move quite a lot if you go from this from the two valencies.
The valency changes. We're not talking about valence change here, right?
Well, you said a molybdenum can be in different valencies, right?
No, Gabby is changing the subject from the subject of this transparency. Maybe we should let him finish this transparency and then go back.
Oh, okay, so it's some...
Because the disorder, it's dynamical versus static disorder.
But yeah, okay. Yeah, so but this is static disorder I'm talking about right now. So, but you're referring back to the fact that if he, the molybdenum 5 plus is molybdenum 6 plus and 4 plus dynamic. See, the point is, at some level, I don't even understand how to interpret this. Because if I think about it, after all, molybdenum is the one that's making it metallic. So if the molybdenum hops, one electron hops from here to the next molybdenum, that molybdenum is 4 plus, and this molybdenum temporarily is 4 plus, right. 6 plus, right?
Right.
So there is, at the time scale of this hopping, so if the bandwidth has become small, that means the residence times have become large. And then I begin to see in the photoelectron spectroscopy, possibly. But you know, I'm getting into the realm of speculation then. So it's a time scale comparison. It gets very fuzzy then. Okay, but more important thing to show over here, see over here, is the order to disorder. See, the magnetization drops drastically. I mean, the magnetization is here about 3.2 Bohr magneton. The perfectly ordered one will have exactly 4 Bohr magneton, and this highly disordered state has about 1 Bohr magneton. So the point that I said, there are two ways this can happen, that you can have the perfectly ordered one, all iron is magnetically ordered, the anti-side defect could go in with an anti-parallel configuration, or it could go in with a depolarization of the molybdenum field, and therefore looking more like this.
So I'm confused now about the completely ordered one, though. Is it ferro or ferri magnetic?
This is a confusion that I insist calling it a ferro and not a ferri, because molybdenum is not a localized moment. The ferro and ferri, the question is, I'm trying to describe only the local moments, how they're organized. Local moment is only on iron. Okay. It is a spin polarized conduction electron that is antiparallelly coupled, but that I will not call a ferri magnet unless that was localized at a site.
Conventionally, one would call it a ferri.
I don't think so. It's only if the other one was also localized.
But the network moment...
May I just
make a correction?
Would you disagree with me or
you? Okay. I would say that you would call it a ferri magnet if the magnetic order breaks the translation symmetry of the crystal. Here it does not break the translation
symmetry. It does not. Symmetry. Exactly. Oh, wonderfully put. That's right.
Inside the unit cell, the moment does alternate, as you say, because it's opposite on moly and on iron. But it still has the full translation invariance of the crystal.
So that's one thing. And the second point to realize is that this down electron that you're trying to say it's ferri, and saying because it's on molybdenum, if you look at the band structure and if you believe the charge partitioning, you'll find that it's equally on iron and on molybdenum and on oxygen.
Yeah, that's quite amazing given your picture. Yeah. That's something we can...
It's a very strongly hybridized.
So then you have an even different definition of ferri. Even if they were local moments, you wouldn't call it ferri.
Correct. It's different energy. It's fine. The point is, it does or doesn't break the translation symmetry of the crystal. I think is the proper definition.
I'm not too sure that will work all the time. Like Fe304 is a classic ferri magnet, but I think the unit cell. Okay, we have to look at it. But from my point of view, it has to be a localized moment. But the one that... It's anti-parallel. And I'm not showing that at all here. I'm showing only the local moments, how they're organized. Okay, and their values. And these are the two possibilities. And it turns out, we did some experiment. Instead of going through this controlling the disorder, which is a very statistical process, and we instead did some experiment where we changed the composition. We pulled out molybdenum and put excess iron. Then I know exactly how many anti-side defects I'm creating, and only one kind of anti-side defect. It's not a coupled one. And likewise, I can pull out an iron and put in molybdenum, and I can create locally exactly the kind of defect that I want. I can study the magnetic property. That's what we did. And then it turns out, I'll just give you the conclusion, that it turns out that both the effects are present. That you have the nearest neighbor iron and iron interaction become antiferromagnetic, and also nearest neighbor molybdenum interaction makes it extremely depolarized, and that weakens also.
So that means that the state is just some kind of sort of ferromagnet plus spinblast state, where local moments are all there.
Absolutely right.
It's simply messed up.
Yeah, absolutely right. Absolutely right. And this is some very important consequence that I'll not be talking about near the surface, where it is even more manifest. So now I go back to the magnetoresistance issue that I showed you, that there's a very strong effect. So again, to remind you of the anti-site business, but whenever I have this anti-site defect, you see that I am creating a sort of a wall of iron inside the nice metal. Since iron nearest neighbor makes it an antiferromagnet, it would be something like an insulator, like LaFeO3. So can this provide me the barrier that I need to get magnetoresistance? Because the magnetoresistance that I'm talking about, and I'll show you, is tunneling magnetoresistance. So the question really is that in this material, do we have tunneling magnetoresistance where the barrier is coming between the physical grains, as normally the case, with some barrier in between, grain boundary material, etc., or inside a single grain because of these anti-site defects providing the barrier locally. And this is a question that was very hot and people wanted to understand, and we sort of addressed this question by making series of samples because we had this control on the extent of disorder and grain size. And by comparing, what we came up with is, I'll not again tell you the big detail. There's a very, very basic curve. I'll just show you that there's a magnetoresistance of a small grain sample, and this is the large grain sample. The color, if it is blue on this side, the blue on that side, they have the same anti-site defect density. And you can see that it's the size of the grain that matters more to decide the magnetoresistance rather than the ordering, extent of ordering. Because extent of ordering is being changed over here, but not much is happening. But as soon as I go from the large grain to the small grain, there's a much larger magnetoresistance I'm getting, which tells me that it is the inter-grain mechanism. That is, here I'm increasing the inter-grain density, inter-grain boundary density, and so I have got much more magnetoresistance. So it's a tunneling magnetoresistance of the classic variety that we know of, where you have the magnetic metallic grains separated by something that provides it a barrier, it's tunneling across. Fortunately, it turned out that it's actually nothing of the kind that you know of tunneling magnetoresistance so far. Tunneling magnetoresistance is very well understood. But beyond this, as soon as we started looking at it more closely, it turned out that the phenomena is drastically different from what you know from tunneling magnetoresistance. And I'll talk about only two aspects of it, which are very easy to follow. One is the fact that tunneling magnetoresistance should have an M squared dependence, which is obvious because you have two magnetic materials, metallic materials, and it has to conduct from here to there, which M for this one tells me how many, essentially, the number of electrons available for hopping, and M for this one tells me how many states are available for it to hop to, and so it has an essentially M squared dependence. Another thing is that, as thinking about the half metallic states, as I told you, that if I had taken this configuration, it would be zero conductance between them, because the electron, upspin electron from here cannot hop there because it doesn't have the right orientation, spin orientation. So immediately you can see that as I apply a magnetic field and start to rotate it around, the highest conductivity state is this, the lowest conductivity state is this, and the magnetoresistance should be highest when I am at the coercivity of the magnetic, which is the state where there's no magnetization. Coercivity refers to the state where bulk magnetization has gone to zero. Okay? Just keep these two points in mind, and let me show you the results. First of all, the coercivity. So this is the MH loop of a particular material, one of these samples that I've shown you, and the coercivity is that point, magnetic field, a very small coercivity, very soft magnet. And this is a magnetoresistance, highly expanded, and its highest magnetoresistance is there, which should be at this field if it is ordinary tunneling magnetoresistance, but it's almost an order of magnitude higher field that the tunneling magnetoresistance maximum appears. And if I plot magnetoresistance as a function of M squared, you can see that hardly anything is happening for the M by M squared. There's no proportionality, first of all, and it's low for most of the magnetization, and there's a switching-like behavior for the last bit of magnetization. In fact, better seen if I plot magnetoresistance as a function of magnetization, you can see that I can magnetize up to something like 80% of the magnetization of the material, and there's hardly any magnetoresistance. And it's in the last 10% of magnetoresistance that there's a switching-like behavior and all the magnetoresistance is realized, which is obviously not a behavior like tunneling magnetoresistance. To cut the long story short, what we interpreted it as, it turns out that the tunneling magnetoresistance concept has been always that you have two grains, metallic magnetic grains, have an insulating barrier, and nobody ever worried about what the magnetic property of that barrier is. If it is hard magnetic material, that insulating barrier, then the entire magnetoresistive property will be controlled by that particular magnetic material rather than the magnetic material of the grains. And that is indeed the case here. So what you're saying, in the magnetization, you're seeing the coercivity of the majority phase, which is this ferromagnetic material. But you're, in the magnetoresistance, you're seeing the minority phase, which is the grain boundary material, and it's the coercivity of that material. And if you take this and model the system along this line, you indeed find that these are some simulations that we did, and you find that almost all the results that you see in experiment can be simulated by this idea. So basically what is going on here is that you have you apply magnetic field, the barrier is highly coercive, so it's in a zero magnetization state, and you have aligned almost completely, but the barrier is not yet allowing anything to move. So it's completely polarized. It's ready to jump across, but it's not being able to do because this door is not yet open. And as soon as it crosses the coercivity of that one, immediately they rush through. It's like a valve, a spin valve created by the hard magnetic material. So we called it the spin valve type magnetoresistance within TMR, because it is a TMR, but the spin valve nature is coming from the hard magnetic material of the barrier layer.
But you reach this conclusion by modeling, essentially. You said that you need to discuss separately the interface region. Do you have direct evidence that the interface is doing what you want it to do?
Yeah, some. See, it's very difficult to probe the interface directly, right? This is not the best illustration, but you might, if you have very good eyes, you'll see it. This is the two materials that have the same disorder, but different grain size. When the grains, this is the large grain size, and this is the small grain size. What you can see is the coercivity has actually increased when I go from large grain size to small grain size, which is telling me the grain surface material is more coercive. If I take the magnetoresistance value and divide it by M squared, because all tunneling magnetoresistance must have an M squared dependence, what I recover is a hysteretic loop. R magnetoresistance divided by M squared looks like an MH loop, right? And you have more data in the sense that we believe that it's not hard magnet, it's actually like a disordered magnetic state. And AC magnetization, because that can see the frequency dependence, so it throws out the large signal coming from the bulk part, and we do see a signature. That I'm not talking about. That's some unpublished data by a colleague of mine. So there are some experimental evidences to the extent one can have. Okay. Now the question is, when I have many anti-site defects, what do they do? The general idea is that it gets scattered around all over the place, statistically distributed. But is that right, or do they cluster, or they segregate in one dimension or two dimension? Because these are issues that become very, very important. And we looked at it, and the indication came from the fact that when we looked at this sample with different ordering, this X-ray diffraction data, and this peak, this little peak is the ordering peak. If this peak vanishes like it has vanished here, it's actually totally disordered. And we can see that we can change the ordering. But we looked at X-ray absorption fine structure, and that told us that it actually is fully ordered, all the samples. Right? It told me that on an average, every molybdenum is surrounded by six irons, and every iron is surrounded by six molybdenum. Didn't matter how much the disorder I had created.
What is the difference between these slimes, the five samples?
These?
Yeah.
The extent of ordering. This was the most ordered, and so the supercell reflection is very intense.
But it's still, they're all still normally 50-50?
They're all SR2FeMO6, all of them, right? By different kind of heat treatment, I'm creating different kind of ordering, and my way of defining ordering has been to look at the X-ray diffraction and look at the supercell reflection,
okay.
Right? And that defined how much the ordering was. And I interpreted that as a statistically distributed ordering. Till I went and did this other experiment, extra absorption fine structure, which is also a probe of the geometric structure, but local. That told me it hardly mattered whether it took the most ordered or most disordered state. Almost all molybdenum had six iron around it, and all iron had six molybdenum around it. It's a completely, radically different statement than what X-ray diffraction said. And the only way to marry these two, in fact, was to say that you're ordering clustered. And so basically you can have all kind of scenarios, right? I mean, the gray, light gray and the darker gray is the normal lattice, the perfectly ordered, and then the red and the blue are the statistically distributed anti-site defects. You can have them completely phase segregate like this. You have a perfect ordered, another perfect ordered, but the relationship between these two is an antiphase boundary. And that size could be anything. And our experiments actually showed that we are in this limit where the typical cluster sizes are in the order of 20 nanometers. So everybody, we have been, including us, we have been thinking about this, and that's not correct. They tend to phase segregate in 20 nanometer, and still it of course has the effect on the magnetization because of the antiphase boundary, would force an antiferromagnetic coupling across the boundary, but farther apart, they'll try to recover. If you have small clusters, they don't recover very well, and so magnetization goes down very strongly.
Well, I don't know why. I mean, if I look at your upper right picture, right, most of the area is gray, so
yes.
It's nice material, right? So in that case, why don't I get a magnetization which is most of the way to the clean system value?
Absolutely right. That is, it's entirely is the density of these clusters, not the size of the clusters. So what I'm changing by when I'm doing the different extent of ordering, actually I'm creating more and more of these. So, and then the reason that I won't get that, because this one and that one will be antiferromagnetically coupled because of the antiphase boundary. This is small enough not to recover. If it was large, I would have a small patch around 10 nanometers or whatever, I don't know the number, which is going to be sort of in a state like this. If it is large enough, then it recovers and I get the moment contribution in the right direction. But if they're small, they don't recover. And that's the reason why you don't get the magnetization.
And by this point, we really believe that this XAF stuff, which has a certain air of kind of witchcraft about it, is really reliable for this
X-ray absorption fine structure. I think it is. I better think, because all my subsequent slides are with XAFs. I actually do, because, and let me show you now some coming more closer home to the subject matter that I originally referred to, real effect of disorder. I'm elucidating different kinds of effects of disorder, but now I'm going to home on to more the effect of disorder on the substituted transition metal oxides, metal insulator transition, and end with some data that we are very excited about, very new, it's not published, and something that I want to initiate discussion with some of you at least. Okay, very quickly, one more to end this story about SR2FeWO6, MOWO6. It turns out that you can make this compound solid solution right across. SR2FeMOO6 is ferromagnetic metal, SR2FeWO6 is antiferromagnetic insulator. The question is, if you change X continuously, how does it evolve from a ferromagnetic metal to an antiferromagnetic insulator? Right? One would have thought that actually XR tells you that you can make the sample right across. It turns out that actually that's not true, so I'll not spend much time. There is a metal insulator transition as the resistivity suggests here. The phase diagram actually can get a homogeneous ferromagnetic metallic state up to some critical concentration of molybdenum up to about 40%. After there's an inhomogeneous phase that comes in between this homogeneous ferromagnetic metallic state and a homogeneous antiferromagnetic insulating state, where you get a mixture of both kinds. So, and
what does PMC stand for on this phase diagram?
Paramagnetic clusters, because that's a phase separated. So you have a primary phase in the high temperature paramagnetic insulator, which will become an antiferromagnetic insulator, but you have this paramagnetic cluster, which makes a transition to ferromagnetic cluster here. And this is the antiferromagnetic phase transition, which is around 37 Kelvin, right? This is also not published.
So basically, just looking at this, the sort of molybdenum and tungsten extreme seems like completely different animals, right? They don't like to.
They don't like, and that's what. Because you know, we've had this puzzling question that how the hell is it going to evolve from a ferromagnetic metal to antiferromagnetic insulator, because all of us were convinced that you can make all the samples.
I mean, it's clear from this they do everything possible.
Yes,
to avoid, right?
Exactly, exactly, precisely that. And so the metal insulator transition that you see is actually percolative in between this, which is a metal with the insulating clusters, and this, which is an insulator with metallic clusters. Okay, now I'm going to show you something, some work that you did quite a while ago. This is a paper from 1997 on the manganites, telling you, showing you how XFs can really get you local structure and give you information about the disorder, because that's our only hope of understanding what disorder does. The properties I can measure, but if I want to see the effect of disorder directly at the local level, XFs is possibly the only technique that's going to give us. This is what we are doing. This is a Debye-Waller factor that we have extracted for two test cases. One is lanthanum manganate, and it's a manganese oxide. Manganese oxide behaves. This is a Debye behavior. I mean, this is a Debye-Waller factor, and that's a fit. It behaves very nicely as it should, and there's very little static disorder. Whereas in the lanthanum manganate, if you analyze the same way, you find that there is a large static disorder. Actually, this static disorder is coming from the fact it's just an artifact of the way we're analyzing, because it has strong Yantella distortion. So there are two different manganese oxygen distances, and I'm analyzing it in terms of one single manganese oxygen distance, and that approximation reflects itself as a strong Debye-Waller factor. But interesting part is that I now can dope the system with strontium or calcium and 0.2, and I, depending on thermal treatment, this insulator to metal transition, this is the resistivity plot, insulator to metal transition, I can put it at different temperatures. In this particular case, the temperature is somewhere around 150, and I can make it better, and I can push it up to 220, 240 or so. I can also make it sharp or broad. I can have another composition, again, broad and sharp and two different temperatures. And then if I compare it with the Debye-Waller factor, first of all, I find that the doped system, the Debye-Waller factor has a non-Debye behavior. The Debye behavior is this dashed line, and these are the experimental data. And I find that this deviation from the Debye behavior happens exactly corresponding to where the resistivity is maximum, or this insulator to metal transition is there. In each case, though composition is the same, I've moved the temperature hugely, and that reflects here as well as here. So there's a very non-Debye behavior, first of all, and that's correlated with this insulator metal transition. And then we also applied magnetic field on it. We had a lot of trouble publishing this paper, and finally in 2002 we published in JPCM. And what turns out, this is the resistivity in absence of magnetic field insulated to metal transition. When you apply the magnetic field, of course, this magnetoresistance, resistance drops. That's a dashed line for two different compositions. Here is the analysis of the MNO bond length. It turns out that even in the doped state, you have two bond lengths, saying that the Yantella distortion survives. It doesn't go off. Even at the lowest temperature, in the most metallic state, there's this non-Debye behavior. And the non-Debye behavior depends on the application of the magnetic field. In fact, the difference between these two bond lengths is what the distortion of Yantella distortion is, and that you can see is changes across the metal insulator transition. This is in absence. The open symbol is for absence of magnetic field. The field symbol is in presence of magnetic field. And the magnetic field indeed clearly shows that suppresses the Yantella distortion, which is like making it more metallic. And so does a non-Debye behavior. This is a Debye-Waller factor. If I look at the Debye-Waller factor, how it changes on application of magnetic field, it has this sharp behavior, which is exactly like the magnetoresistance behavior. So it looks like that the Debye-Waller factor actually is a very good probe for local distortions, essentially. This this is something that I believe we see indication of it in electron spectroscopy.
Okay,
it's something that has not been paid attention to by many. I can give very convincing view from core level studies. Mm-hmm. We have published that long ago, that you have this. This is something that, in fact, Gabby and I looked at it many years ago for the valence band also, that you seem to find, even in the valence band data, you take lanthanum calcium vanadate. The valence band spectrum can be described in terms of lanthanum vanadate and calcium vanadate summed up together. Right? This is something that 1995, 96, I think we had a paper, and he showed within DMFT there's a good rationalization for that observation when you have disorder, then disorder. That time, of course, the issue was, you know, at the theoretical end that we assumed all these disorders reflecting in the diagonal energy of the transition metal ion site, and that's statistically two levels, and then it's
separate. What you are saying is that if I take lanthanum strontium TiO3, I have D1 and D0.
Yes.
And
this is something, yes.
I hardly found a metal.
This is something, but you see, it again boils down to interpretation. But the core level, if I show, you will see two peaks there. If you take their intensities and take the ratio, it comes out exactly as the composition dictated. It's an amazing fact, and very few people, nobody has dared to stick their neck out to say that this is actually telling me that the underlying thing is all the time looking like titanium D0 and D1, or D1 and D2. Mm-hmm. And in the valence band also, it looks very additive. I mean, these are the papers that we published more than 10 years ago.
But this is all a question of time scale.
This is that's why I came back at
it. It has to be true on the time scale relevant to oxygen motion.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Andy, that's what the reason the core level we didn't stick our neck out too far is the question is that there's a very strong core hole,
yeah,
and that has a localization effect, right? And that complicates matters.
Yeah.
And in fact, if you think of it, you find it quite amazing that you should see two peaks in a metallic state.
Oh.
The core hole should be, it's such a large energy scale, should pop, kick the hole out from the site always. And it doesn't. And that makes me worry about some question I was trying to ask Gabby yesterday, that can you always throw oxygen out? Because if you don't have oxygen in your model, and if you have only transition metal, you'll always have the hole kicked out of the system. Because the hole gets localized because you have a large charge transfer energy between the oxygen and the metal. And if the oxygen is not there, then so. But on the other hand, the issue that I have not been able to understand, and I would like to discuss with you guys, is that that's for the core level, that I definitely need the oxygen explicitly and for the emission. Do I need the oxygen explicitly for the valence band also? My personal bias is that yes, you do.
Because from the point of view of the Hall effect, I mean, most of the data over the whole metallic range, from STO to, you know, where X critical is, can be explained by just the picture that you dope electron into STO, and then that you form a gradually larger Fermi surface in that RH.
STO is, and doping of STO with lanthanum,
mm-hmm,
is a very clean thing in the sense that the metal insulator transition is almost vanishing X critical. Strontium titanate doped with lanthanum is, as I said, 0.04, 0.03.
Right, so on the titanium side, that's what you mean.
No. You have to do it in the lanthanum titanate doped with strontium. Don't do it at the strontium titanate doped with lanthanum.
Well, I mean, I can look at both ends.
Yeah, you can, but what I'm saying that the strontium titanate with lanthanum doping, I know that it's almost like as I would expect for a homogeneous system, just from experiment, I need trivial amount of doping to make it metallic. The surprising systems are those where I need macroscopic amount of doping.
Remind me, I mean, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that one of the puzzles at the time, which is more than 10 years ago, was that actually you would expect a rather low concentration of electrons when you dope lanthanum into STO, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, you would expect very weak coalition effect.
That's right.
And one of the puzzles at the time was that you didn't really get that. you had something which was quite strongly correlated, even for rather large lanthanum concentrations.
Yes. Yes.
So I don't. No.
There are two issues here. Okay, I understand. So there are two different things that we are talking about. One is the observation of how much doping I need of electron into STO to make it metallic.
Yeah, right? Very small.
Very small.
Yeah,
So that's different from what I was talking about. All this. Okay. Now, exactly. No. Exactly. Band insulated and doping. Exactly. So the other issue that we did discuss is the fact that if you start with the band insulator, you put one or two electrons or three electrons, they are on an average so far apart, Coulomb interaction should have absolutely no impact on it, and yet it does seem to have impact. Right? Because if you looked at the electronic structure, one saw that there are features one would explain as incoherent.
Nevertheless, the whole number all the way from STO to 80% lanthanum doping is just the naive answer, if we believe the plot I have in front of me from Tokoa.
Okay, yeah. That's the one I was trying to recall. That's right. So. I would say that I would be really, tell me one thing. No, that's fine. So up to 20%, that really is, what is interesting is that brings me to the end of the lanthanum titanate doped with strontium. Maybe we can have it projected.
Oh, no? It's just a straight line.
Others. No. How much is the value there? Doping?
It goes all the way from STO.
Excuse me. Can somebody tell me what's the point of this discussion? How does it relate back to
No. I was interested in it for a specific reason that I was still going back to looking at the lanthanum titanate end, and I was trying to see how many charge carriers were available. And then I was trying to see the trend. If I tried to extrapolate, will it give a discontinuous jump or a continuous jump? And it's critical whether it's indicative in the extrapolated range. That was my interest. But
right, and the answer is no. There is no sign of X critical in the Hall effect data as there are one.
It's not going to the. It goes from strontium titanate end up to.
Right. But if we just take what is available, it doesn't really know about. You wouldn't guess what X critical was from the Hall effect data until you get there. If you just make a naive extrapolation over that range, it only knows maybe about X equals zero and not about X critical. Is that the basic answer?
In that one, I'm not too sure.
The first observation just follows the band structure.
Right. So it doesn't even know X equals zero. It doesn't know anything about
all
it.
All right.
Yeah. So if you want from the multi-insulated side, which is what you guys were discussing, it just looks like the conventional answer forming a large family surface, which is what cuprates do not do.
Right.
That it will jump up.
In particular, the carrier density doesn't start from his XC. When you go beyond XC,
it does suddenly boom, jumps up, and that is what would be indicated by this data. But I would like to see more before I add.
In other words, RH has nothing to do with the carrier density. That's another way.
Then we can come back to that.
We're getting more complicated stuff. Yeah, but probably, I don't know. Okay, so that's it.
What do you